Staff of Catholic Family Welfare Bureau in Melbourne and Centre Care, the Catholic Family Welfare Bureau here in Sydney, I'd like you to join me in warmly welcoming Father John Powell SJ.
Thank you very much for the very warm welcome. I'm very pleased to be here. I think you know that I am a Jesuit priest, right? And Jesuit priests, like myself, are usually teachers. And you can always tell a teacher, but you can't tell them much. And that's the first problem we have tonight. The second problem is that Jesuits very often are chancy. You can't quite be sure. When our order was first started, the other orders, the older orders, could not believe that we were really serious. They said, "O Jesuite, nec cantant nec rubricant." That's Latin. I used to know a little Latin, but she moved out of our neighborhood. The translation is, "Oh, the Jesuits, they don't chant the office, and they don't know how to conduct liturgical services." And I must say, we have been very faithful to that reputation down through the centuries. And the latest story I heard was that in heaven, last Christmas, they were going to have a nativity celebration. And little Jesus was in the crib, and Mary was kneeling there, and Joseph standing off with the shepherds. And they decided to have the founders of religious orders bring up the gifts. The wise men from the East, you know. And he laid it at the crib, and everybody in heaven looked at the solid gold missal and said, "Ooh." And then Dominic came up with a solid gold chain rosary with diamond beads and laid it at the crib, and everybody in heaven again went, "Ooh." And then Francis of Assisi came up with a little sculpted bird, and he laid it at the crib. And everybody in heaven went, "Aww." And then our founder, St. Ignatius Loyola, got up. And St. Ignatius had a bad limp. Before he became a saint, he was a soldier, and his right knee was shattered by a cannonball at the Battle of Pamplona. And he had to lie in traction for a whole year. The question, "Are you pulling my leg?" is originally attributed to St. Ignatius. And while he was lying in traction, he read the lives of the saints, and he said, "If they can do it, so can I." And you all know the rest of the story. He became a great saint, and he founded the Great Order of School Teachers. Well, Ignatius got up, and he was limping toward the crib, and then he walked right past it. And the people in heaven who speak Latin nudged each other and said, "O Jesuite, nec cantant, nec rubricant." And then they noticed something worse. He didn't have a gift in his hands. And they said, "This is known as a typical performance by a Jesuit. He does not have a gift. He does not know where he's going. He's walked right past the crib. He walked right past Mary." They said, "I think he thinks he's supposed to be a shepherd." But the fact of the matter is that Ignatius went over to St. Joseph, and he put his arm around St. Joseph's shoulder, and the story goes that he whispered in the ear of St. Joseph, "Where are you going to send the boy to school?" That one goes over in Chicago, too. In a bit more serious vein, my whole identity is involved in being a Jesuit priest. And for me, the idea of priest has the theological significance of someone who is participating in the one priesthood of Jesus as mediator between God and man. I see my whole role in life, my whole identity, the whole gift and commitment of my person to the priesthood to mean this, that it is my life as far as I can to bring man to God and to bring God to man. Tonight, I would like to talk about man, how the priest must be in touch with the heart of man in order to be a priest. And he must also, at the same time, be in touch with the heart of God. If he loses either of those connections, he has, in a sense, forfeited his effectiveness. Because a priest has to be this. He has to be deeply in touch with the heart of man and deeply in touch with the heart of God. Tonight, as I say, I would like to talk on the heart of man, and then on Friday night, at this same time and in the same place, I would like to speak about the heart of God. After I finished my Jesuit training, and I think you probably know that we are all seriously overeducated, I had 4 master's degrees and a doctorate degree. I don't say that boastfully, I hope. But simply that all that academic knowledge was somehow sterile as far as the heart of man was concerned. When after all the academic knowledge and degrees were completed, I was asked to fill in for a hospital chaplain for a couple of months. And when I went to the hospital, a thought struck me like thunder. I've never seen anyone die. And then I thought, and I've never seen anyone born. And I've never seen anyone covered with blood. I've never seen anyone in that raw grief that follows death. When I was going through the seminary, all of these sites were quarantined out of sight for us. When someone got very sick, he went off to the hospital. And if he died, the next time we saw him, he was laid out in his coffin. And while I was eating the first night as hospital chaplain, I was summoned to a boy, to a corpse in the morgue, the corpse of a young man who had burned to death in his car. And as I was going down to the morgue to give him the conditional last anointing, I thought, I had better prepare my eyes. I've never seen a charcoal corpse. And when I got there, it wasn't my eyes that needed the preparation, it was my nose. I didn't know that cremated flesh smelled that way. And the next morning when I was eating breakfast, I was called to a young girl who had shot herself. She was dead, again in the morgue. She put a gun up into her mouth and she sent a bullet sizzling through her brain. And I stood there after I gave her the conditional last sacraments. I stood there looking at the dark rings under her eyes that indicated that she probably hadn't slept for a long time. And I remember asking her, kind of a soliloquy, why did you kill yourself? The identification here says you were 23 years old. You had your whole life ahead of you. Why did you kill yourself? Maybe things were black now, but they could change. Why did you kill yourself? And while I was standing there asking the questions of the girl's body, the morgue attendant brought in the nearest of kin, and he looked at her, and I would have to characterize his reaction as disgust. He looked at her, and he shook his head, and he said, yeah, that's her. And he walked out. And I remember thinking, oh, I think I know a little bit more about why you're here. If that was your nearest of kin, if that was someone who was supposed to have loved you, oh, I think I understand more about those rings under your eyes and the bullet in your brain. I think I understand. What I'm trying to say is that many of us have received a lot of technical, scientific education. But somehow that education has to be tested in the laboratory of life. To understand the heart of man, you must agonize with the heart of man. You must rejoice with the heart of man. You must suffer and enjoy with the heart of man. Academic knowledge isn't enough. I also recall one time when I was asked to give a priest's retreat, and I was a young man then. And I was standing outside the chapel as my retreatants marched in, and they looked very venerable to me. And I thought, as I saw them walk in, including two bishops, I shouldn't have gotten into this. This could be tragic. And I was standing out there psyching myself up, saying, I didn't invite myself, you invited me. And the Monsignor who was running the retreat house came up to me and he said, how do you feel? And I said, scared. And he said, of what? And I said, didn't you see them? Didn't you see them as they walked into chapel? He said, oh, and he put his arm around me and he said, you know, they just need what everybody else needs, a little love and understanding. And I remember saying, why don't they look like it? But I have found out in that priest's retreat and also in the laboratory of life, I have found that this is true. No matter what the veneer, no matter what the mask, this is what the heart of man is looking for, love and understanding. Sometimes we throw each other off. We act as though we don't need love and understanding. We put on airs of self-complacency, but we all need that. We need to be loved, and we need to be understood. After I was ordained, I was going around giving a lot of retreats, lectures. I have a lot of mileage on my mouth. And one of the couples that made a retreat under me called me up and they said, I was teaching in a seminary at the time, they said, Father, would you speak to our 18-year-old daughter? She's an alcoholic. Would you talk to her? And I said, sure, you know, bring her in. And so they did. It was Sunday afternoon and the father stormed in, and this was not his name but his manner. He said, I'm General Bull Moose and this is the kid. And he pointed to this 18-year-old girl who was standing in a less than friendly posture with a less than friendly look on her face. And he said, do you want to hear her latest? And we were standing in the door of the seminary and I said, right here? You want to unload on her right here? Oh, no, I don't want to hear her latest. He said, what do you want me to do? And I said, why don't you take a walk out in the gardens and take your wife with you? They're lovely gardens. So the parents went out, and I went into a visiting parlor with a girl, and I said, you didn't want to come, did you? And she said, what was your first clue? And I said, your face, honey, your face. If you feel all right, please notify your face. However, it wasn't long before my Irish charm had melted her. And she said, do you want to hear my latest? And I said, I am dying to hear your latest. Your father gave you great advanced publicity there. And she said, I chugged a bottle of vodka. Now, for the sweet innocent among you, in case the term isn't used in Australia, when you you do know the term. When you chug a bottle of vodka, she drank the whole bottle right down. And I said, you chugged a whole bottle of vodka? She said, yeah. And I said, what happened? And she says, how am I supposed to know? They had to get a doctor to revive me. The accent, by the way, it's what we call the Hoosier twang. It's found in southern Indiana. They had to get a doctor to revive me. And I said, what else do you do for fun? And she told me. And I want to tell you, she wasn't putting any nickels in the collection box on Sunday. But one thing that kept appearing as kind of a refrain in her conversation was that her father kept accusing her all the time, accusing her of things she had not yet done. And she said, so one day I said to myself, if you got the name, you might as well have the game. So I started doing what he accused me of. And so after we talked for an hour or so, the parents came in from the garden, and I said, would you let me talk to your parents alone? And she said, what are you going to tell them? And I said, I think you can trust me. She says, all right, I'll trust you. So I went in and I asked the father, do you show your children affection? He said, I am not the gushy type. And I said, that was not my question, whether you are the gushy type or not. My question was, do you show your children affection? And his little wife was sitting over there saying, but she wouldn't say it out loud. And that was General Bullmoose. And I said, I think your children need you to love them. He said, look, I'm a good moral man. I set an example. Yes, and I said, and that's very valuable. It really is. But the human heart needs more than a good example. I'm afraid this 18-year-old daughter of yours, I'm afraid she's not to be reclaimed. I think you've lost her. But I know that you have other little children at home, and I think you really ought to think about this. That they need you to love them. So he did not like my diagnosis, so he took his wife and they went home. But the girl said on her way out, could I come back and see you? I said, sure. I was confident it was my charm. Sure, you can come back. And she came back. She came back 75 miles she drove every Saturday. And each time I saw her, I liked her less. She always talked about herself. She never talked about anyone else with any feeling. And the only time she ever mentioned other people was when they did her wrong. They weren't fair to her. They didn't give her way. And one day she came in and she said, I'm gonna get even with them. Oh, I'm gonna get even with them. And I said, oh, pray tell, who is it now, honey? And she said, my mother and father. I said, what did they do now? She says, they wouldn't let me go to the rustic, which is a terrible dive. Do you use that word? It's a dive. A bad place. And I said, why wouldn't they let you go? And she says, I don't know. And I said, maybe we can think of a reason. She says, I told you, I don't know. And I said, that's why. I said, maybe we could think of a reason. Maybe they love you. She says, oh, they don't love me. Maybe they don't. Maybe they do, and you've never really opened to that. If you were my daughter, I wouldn't want you at that rustic. I've heard of how people get hurt there. Their faces get cut with the bottoms of broken beer bottles. I wouldn't want you there. She says, oh, get off it. And so I decided that what this girl needed was to be told that there are people in the world with real problems, so she didn't exaggerate her own. And I said, do you know that there are people in the world right now who are starving to death? Do you know that on the streets of many cities in India, they just sweep up the bodies of the victims of starvation every morning? Do you know that? Do you know that right here in America, that there are people who are combing through garbage cans to find the food to stay alive? And to keep their children alive? Do you know that? Do you know that there are people who have a demon called cancer inside of them that is eating away their guts? They're dying inch by inch, day by day. Do you know that? Do you know that there are people who are really lonely? Nobody cares about them. Nobody knows their name. And the only relief they get from this loneliness is the taste of cheap wine or a hypodermic needle in the arm. Do you know that? And after I finished what I considered to be a rather dramatic description of some of the problems in the world, she put her hand pertly on her hip and said, name two. And I said, you need a Copernican revolution. You know who Copernicus was? Do you remember that? He discovered that the sun doesn't really revolve around the earth, but the earth around the sun. And what you need to know, my dear, is that the whole world does not really revolve around you. But you were meant to revolve around the world, to be concerned about someone besides yourself. You know what? You're living in a population, a world that has a population of one. One, you. And she said, goodbye. And she grabbed her things and she walked out. And I walked to the door with her, and I remember my last remark was, would you think about it, please? Would you just think about it? I knew she wouldn't be back. And I thought about that. I wondered, did I do the right thing? Should I have confronted her that way? And sometime later, a psychiatrist came to talk at the seminary. He's not the one who treats me. He came to lecture at the seminary, and after his lecture, I said to him, Doctor, I am on the faculty here at the seminary, which I was, and we keep beer in the infirmary for medicinal purposes only. But the faculty is allowed to go up to the infirmary for such medicine. Could I give you a glass of beer for a little free advice? And he said that would be a fair trade. So when we sat down, I said, Doctor, how do you teach someone to love? And I don't know if you know this, but psychiatrists very often reserve a certain smile for celibates. It's kind of a weak, patronizing, anemic smile that could be verbalized, only a priest would ask that question. And when he gave me the smile, I said, Doctor, please, I do not wish to be treated like a little boy. Don't sit me down in your lap now and give me that talk. I'm asking you a serious question, and I would like a man-to-man answer. How do you teach people to love? And he said, well, at least give me this. No psychiatrist is ever expected to answer a question without asking one. Why are you asking that question? So I told him the story that I've just shared with you about the little girl. And he said, now you do want me to talk to you like a big man. I said, right on, doctor, right on. And he said, well, I think you hurt her very badly. And I think you might have hurt her irrevocably. I said, are you serious? He said, of course I'm serious. I think you did her very serious damage. He said, when she came in, she was hurting. Really hurting. Because her father had convinced her, he had absolutely brainwashed her to believe that she's no good. You don't treat someone like that, the way he wanted to treat her. Do you want to hear her latest? Unless you regard them as scum. And she believes that. She believes that she's scum. And when she came, she was really hurting. And that's why people don't love. And that's something that you have to know. They don't love because they're hurting. And then he asked me a question that turned into one of the great insights of my life. He said, did you ever have a toothache? And I said, yes. He said, whom were you thinking about when you had your toothache? And I said, me. Me. I was thinking of me. He said, right. And who else? The dentist. Any dentist. Anyone who could relieve me of that pain. He said, right. That's the way most people are, you know. They're hurting. They're hurting like that little girl. And of course they're self-centered. When you had your toothache, if someone tried to get your attention, you would have flashed a sign, nobody home, nobody home, I'm hurting. I can't be available to you. I hurt too much. That girl, when she came in to you, she was really hurting. When she drank the vodka, she was trying to kill herself. Did you realize that? It's what we call an occult attempt at suicide. If you find a dead young girl with a bullet in her head, and a gun in her hand, you know she shot herself. But if you find her next to an empty bottle of vodka, you might say, oh, the poor thing, she didn't know. This girl knew. This girl is an habitual drinker. She knew. And I would bet anything, the doctor said, that when the doctor came to revive her and consciousness began to come back in, there was a deep moan in her soul. Oh, don't. Don't make me come back. Please. Please just let me sleep. And of course, what she did not want to come back to was herself. She hates herself. The second highest cause of fatality in the college age group is suicide. She hates herself. Among the other things the girl had told me that I shared with the doctor was that she had a boyfriend who was never sober, and he had never held a job. He was known in that little Indiana town as the classical bum. And the doctor said, why did she pick him for a boyfriend? Because she feels that he's on her level. She does not want to relate to a saint. She couldn't breathe the same air as the saint. So she picks a bum because she thinks she's a bum, because her father has convinced her she's a bum. She's acting like a bum. And she doesn't go to church. Oh, she couldn't go to church. And she might make up any number of reasons why she's not going. I don't get much out of it. But maybe in her case, the real reason was that if she ever went into church, she would hear God say to her, not that God would say this, but she, in her own distorted way of thinking about herself, would hear God say, what are you doing here, you slut? What are you doing in my house? My house is a house of prayer. And she couldn't chance that. So she doesn't go near God. And she came here under duress. Her parents kidnapped her and brought her to you. And that very first day, you were kind to her. You told her father, you know, I think your children need to be loved. I think you have to show them that you love them. The human heart needs love and understanding, and I don't think you're giving it to your children. I think you've driven this girl to drink. You're a good example, but you're not very loving. And the girl said, can I come back? Can I come back to see you? And you were confident it was your charm. But it wasn't your charm. You were the dentist. You were the dentist to her pain. She was hurting. And you promised. You gave her hope that you would tell her she wasn't as bad as her father told her she was. And she said, can I come back? Can I please come back? And you said, sure. And you held out hands that promised to be gentle. Yes, sure, you can come back. And she came back. And she is a child. She's 18 years old, and she has an 8-year-old set of emotions because she hates herself. People who hate themselves never really grow up. Because growing up, because maturing involves making decisions, and to make decisions and take responsibility implies belief in yourself, and she has none. And she saw you as her dentist. And she came to you. And every time you preached your little sermons to her and she backed away, she was really saying to you, please don't tell me I'm as bad as my father has been telling me I am, please. And on that last day, you told her. You said to her, I don't like you either. Your father's right about you. And I don't like you either. And I said, doctor, I really didn't say that. And he said, oh, father, please, please. There's something you must understand. It isn't what you say to people that counts. It's what they hear. And when you say to a person, you know what you need? You need a Copernican revolution. You need to find out that the whole world doesn't really revolve around you. Do you have to add, I don't like you? Or haven't you already said that? And all I could say to the doctor was, touché. You're right. He said, you can't teach people to love. Love is a free decision that a person must make. But you can help people. You can facilitate them to make that decision. You can help them. But you have to understand why they don't love. You have to understand what it is that locks them inside themselves. It's pain. It's pain, and sometimes that pain isn't too dramatic or exterior. Sometimes that pain is deep inside of a person. He hates himself. Oh, he will never give you the satisfaction of knowing that. He will never say it explicitly. But if he's all turned in on himself, if he does live in a world that has a population of one, you can be sure of this, he's hurting. And he's looking for a dentist. He's looking for love and understanding. He's looking for some belief in himself. After the doctor finished, I felt very sad. And I wrote the girl a love letter. And I hope when they publish the final anthology of love letters in the English language that I get at least an honorable mention. And I asked her if she would please come back, that I wanted to speak to her again. Would you please come back? And when she came back and she walked into the seminary, I gave her a big hug and I felt her stiffen. And she said, what does this mean? And I said, Rosie, what does it mean when you give someone a hug? And she looked up at me, and I remember the look on her face. She said, you don't like me. And I said, Rosie, would you try to believe this? I want to like you. I really want to like you. Would you give me another chance? And she pulled away, but she walked into the visiting parlor. And we resumed our visits. And she really didn't change. She didn't come back a mature young woman. She came back the same little impudent child. But I had changed. I had found out something in the laboratory of life that really changed me. That people who don't love are hurting. They're turned in on themselves by their very pain. And I kept remembering the question, did you ever have a toothache? Do you remember wanting only a dentist? Someone who would relieve you of your pain? And so when she would tell her immature little stories and act like a child, I understood. She was the same, but I was different. In all the little sermons that I volunteered to give in our previous set of visits, I gave up. I retired my portable pulpit. I stopped talking to her about changing and just tried to reflect this to her, that I take you where you are. I accept you as you are. I love you as you are. And one day she walked in and said, you know what I did? I said, what'd you do, Rosie? She said, I went to confession. I'm going to church again. I said, oh, I'm really happy to hear that. And then she told me, oh, I've given up drinking. Yes, I don't drink anymore. And then she said she was going with a nice boy and they intended to be married. And they did get married. And they now have a family. And every Christmas, Rosie sends me a picture of her family on the Christmas card. And there she is with her husband and these nice little children. They're all smiling. And every time I sit with that card at Christmas time and look at those smiling faces, I ask myself this question. What if the psychiatrist hadn't come to the seminary? What if the last words she heard from me were, you need a Copernican revolution. You need to find out that the whole world doesn't really revolve around you. And he's right, the psychiatrist was right. It isn't what you say to people, it's what they hear you say. And she was certainly hearing me say, your father was right about you. I don't like you either. And so I have often remembered that question, did you ever have a toothache? And especially when I see obnoxious qualities arising in me and in other people, especially in very young people who are trying to find a sense of their own worth, you have to remember that. That underneath the obnoxious qualities is pain, is hurt. And what they're really saying is, would you love me? Would you? Would you love me as I am? I am now convinced that the heart of man is just desperate for this kind of love and understanding. But there's something about the love you give to people that is absolutely necessary. It's the only kind of love that helps people, and that is unconditional love. Most of us bear scars. All of us bear some psychological scars. Most of us have a pain inside of us, and we're looking for a dentist. We feel lonely, we feel discouraged, we feel depressed. And the problem psychologically all goes back to the same source. When you are loved only conditionally, when you are loved because you got good grades in school, because you kept your clothes clean, because you acted like your older brother or sister, because you never caused me any trouble, if that's why you were loved, if that's what you heard, then you grew up without a sense of your own worth. Eric Fromm says, people who are loved only conditionally, only if they pay the price of admission to somebody's love, in the end, don't feel loved at all. They feel used. You didn't love me. You loved my athletic ability. You loved my intelligence. You loved my good behavior, you loved my religiosity, whatever it was, you didn't love me. When I satisfied you, when I got good grades, when I came home a winner, you hugged me. But when I didn't, you were cold. You were cold to me, you didn't love me. And you have to really ask yourself about that, because it's the only kind of love, I am convinced of this, it's the only kind of love that really helps people. If you say, I'll love you as long as you're sweet and nice and pleasant, I think Jesus would say, even the heathens do this. I ask you to love those who are sick and lonely and locked inside themselves and have nothing to offer you but need. The hurting, the ones who hate themselves and try to mask that with a mask of sarcasm and other obnoxious qualities. Can you love them? The human heart needs this unconditional love and understanding. Because if we aren't loved, without that fine print in the contract, we do feel used. You didn't really love me. Recently, I was talking to a woman who had been diagnosed by her doctor as having a very debilitating disease. Her health will gradually weaken, and her ability to do things, to move, will gradually diminish. At the time of the diagnosis, she was engaged to be married. And when she told the man to whom she was engaged that she had received this diagnosis, he went to the doctor, and he asked the doctor, what's the prognosis? And when the doctor told him, he immediately broke the engagement, and he left her. Now, I want you to understand this. I'm not condemning this man. I'm not judging him. If he didn't think he had the strength to do this, then he did the right thing. But what she said to me indicated the desire of the human heart to be loved unconditionally. She said, I'm sick, but I'm still me. I'm still me, and I remember she was crying as she said, I think he loved me for what I could do and not for who I was. And this is tremendously important, that when we love a person, we take them exactly as they are, wherever they are, hurting, immature, obnoxious. I love you. I don't love you because you're good. I don't love you because you're kind. I give you my love. You have it. This is the way God loves us, unconditionally. God says, I take you as you are. I love you. And I am convinced of this, that in the parable of the prodigal son, what Jesus was really saying is, in the person of that little father hugging his son, taking him back, God was really saying, I take you wherever you are. I don't care where you've been or what you've done. You know what I really want? That you're home with me. I want you with me because I love you. I love you. You have my love. I'm convinced that we are all saying to God, try this slowly on your own psyche. Will you please ask yourself this question? Do you feel that if you change, then God will be able to love you? If you change. But I mean, you've got to shape up. You've got to change, and then God will love you. And you know what I think God is saying to us when we say this, when we think this way? God is saying, no, you have it all wrong. All wrong. You don't have to change so I will love you. I love you so you can change. You have my love. You have my love, and you need to know you have my love in order to change. It doesn't work the other way. Viktor Frankl, the psychiatrist, tells the story of a married couple coming to him, and the man was a neatnik. Everything had to be in order. And if he came home to a clean house, to a well-cooked meal, was not at all burned, had to be right, and to neat children, he hugged his wife. He was very affectionate to her. But if something displeased his eye as he gave the house the white glove test, he turned her off. And she told Dr. Frankl this. She said, if I keep the house clean, you know, he's affectionate and loving, but if I don't, he's cold. And the man said, that's right, yes. I work very hard. I have the right to come home to a neat house, to well-cooked food, and to clean children. She's right. And the woman said, but I need to know he loves me, whether I have the house clean or not, in order to get the strength to clean the house. Dr. Frankl agreed with the wife. You need to know that you are loved. You need to know you are loved. Whether your performance is good or bad or mediocre, you need to know that someone loves you. Someone's on your side. Someone cares for you. And then you will have the psychological strength to live that way. But if you don't know, if the love you receive is only conditional, I think you're in trouble. The human heart cannot live without love. You're nobody till somebody loves you. Until somebody loves you unconditionally. A Jewish singer, dancer, a woman named Lillian Roth. And she became an alcoholic and a dope addict, and she wandered through about 5 marriages. And finally, she seemed to recover. And she wrote her life, I'll Cry Tomorrow. And people asked her, how did you do it? How did you ever come back from all that addiction and dissipation? And she said, simple, I found someone who loved me. Someone who came to me and said, I love you. And didn't ask anything, didn't have conditions in the contract. Just said, I loved you. And then I was able to change. We need to know that. Our problem is that if we were loved only conditionally, if nobody ever said, I just love you, period, we're always trying to please people. We're always trying to buy love by performing, by looking pretty, by acting smart, by being good, by trying to please them. And we don't have a sense of our own worth. We don't know that what's really important is what we are, and we keep thinking it's important what I do. And this was the first great insight, I think, of mine in the laboratory of life. The people really need love and understanding. The priest was right. All they need is love and understanding, but it has to be unconditional love. I'm convinced of that. And when I ask myself, why does love have such a poor record? Why are there more divorces in my country than there are marriages? Why can't people stay in love? I once read a poem that young love is like tinsel. It makes a lot of noise, it's bright and crinkly, but over the years it matures into something that is much more quiet, less bright, but much more valuable. The tinsel becomes gold. And I wondered, why doesn't the tinsel become gold? As a priest, when I'm driving and I see a couple in front of me and it looks like two heads are sticking out of one pair of shoulders, I somehow intuit they're not married. But if she is sitting over against the opposite door and gesticulating, I somehow conclude they are married. And I ask myself, why is that? And I want to tell you what my conclusion is. My conclusion is that most people never learn to communicate. That communication is the secret of staying in love. And by communication, I mean sharing. When you communicate, it means you have something in common with another person. Literally, that's what the word means, to have something in common. And when you communicate with another human being, what do you have in common? Not the building you live in or the food you eat, but yourselves. You know me, and I know you. This is what we have in common, each other. And I'm convinced that when love fails, it is because the couple has not communicated. They've never really shared who they are. Well, they've talked about things and they've engaged in little tug of war, tug of wills. They've argued. But in order to really share yourself, and I would like you to really think about my thesis, you must share your deepest feelings. You know, you can talk all you want about your ideas. I can stand up here and say, I'm a priest. And you say, yeah, but there are a lot of them around. You didn't really tell me something that individuates you. But if I tell you how I feel about being a priest, tell me about your loneliness. Tell me what it's like to be a priest on Saturday night. Tell me what it's like to offer Mass and hold up the people of God under the veils of bread and wine. Tell me about your exhilaration when God has used you to help someone or to preach His word. Tell me those things and then I will know you. But don't stand up and tell me I'm a priest. Don't give me your thoughts. I will suspect that you've just read another book. And as you prepare to give your sermon, I can hear the can opener. You're going to give me another one of those. Tell me who you are by telling me how you feel. Because no one has ever felt exactly as you have. You and I, we've never had really many original ideas, have we? I often thought if I ever get an original idea, it will probably die of lonesomeness. You know, Seriously, I think I've written about 10 books, and people say, oh, you know, you've written 10 books, and I want to say, yeah, but I stole everything in them. If you steal one idea from one man without acknowledging it, you know, that's called plagiarism. But if you steal many things from many men without acknowledging it, that's called research. Thank you. What I'm trying to say is that I am a researcher. I don't lay claim to any original ideas, not even the ideas I'm submitting to you tonight. But you know what? Nobody has ever felt as I do. My sadness is like no one else's sadness. My joys are like no one else's joys. And when I tell you how I feel about being a priest, you know, no other priest has ever felt that way. And my feelings about being a priest, they vary. Some mornings I wake up and I sit on the edge of the bed and I say, Jesus, I don't feel like being a priest today. They're going to devour me again. Sometimes, Jesus, you know, I feel like the town pump. Everybody comes and uses me and they all walk away. You know, you were right about those 10 lepers. Only one came back. That's some morning. But I always immediately assure him, of course I will be a priest. I mean, I gave you my word, but I want to tell you how I feel, because that's when you get to know me. And that's when I get to know myself. And some mornings I say, hey, Jesus, where are those mountains you want moved? But it's when I tell you my feelings that I tell you who I am. Now, please understand, I am not saying that the most important thing about you or me is our feelings. It's not true. They are not the most important thing. You know, feelings come and feelings go, right? Your capacity to love, your virtue, your sanctifying grace, these are really much more important in the order of being. But in the line of communication, sharing yourself with another human being, nothing is more important than your feelings. That's the only way you can share yourself. You can talk all you want about ideas, you can debate all you want about choices, but you never lay yourself on the line until you tell someone else how you feel. Now, I happen to feel very strongly about this because I came out of a marriage. My mother and father never knew each other. I came out of a marriage in which there was no communication like this. They were good people. They're both dead. They never divorced. They lived together. They lived out their truths. But they never really knew each other. And I think if an angel were to come and inscribe on their tombstone a proper epitaph for their marriage, it would have to read, here lie two good and decent people who never knew each other. They didn't. I remember that the marriage was kind of going along. And I was 12 years old, and we were poor. Man, were we poor. We couldn't afford roller skates and footballs and things like this because my father, poor man, never made much money. And the man across the street, who lived across the street from us, he bought us these things, the footballs, the roller skates, and we were always dutifully grateful. But every Saturday night, my father, who was a salesman on commission, would bring home a little brown envelope and hand it to my mother, and she would examine the contents and say, Will, how do I make ends meet on $30 a week? How do you raise three children, Will, on $30 a week? And the poor man would just hang his head and walk away. And my mother's a good woman, a saintly woman. She had to worry. He gave her the brown envelope, and then he walked away, and she had to pay the bills, and she had to reheat the leftovers, and she had to sew the clothes. And she kept asking him, Will, how do I do it? And when I was 12 years old, she came home one night, and she said, have I got good news for all of you? I've got a job. The Board of Education is taking me in to teach in a vocational high school, and they're starting me out at $125 a week. And we all cheered except my father. He said, don't take it. And she said, why not? Why not? On what you're making, we can't even have the roof repaired. You can never send these children to school, to college. Then what you're making? He said, don't take it. And she said, why not? And sadly enough, it seemed so typical of their relationship. They never knew each other. He didn't tell her that he felt like a failure, that his brother was a famous lawyer, his sister taught literature in a university. He didn't tell her that when your brother, who's a labor union president, declares that a testimonial dinner should be given in his honor, that I don't even know where to get the money to rent a tuxedo to go. He didn't tell her what it was like to come home with that brown envelope and hand it to her and then hang his head. And now she came home and she said she had a job. And he didn't tell her how it felt. He didn't tell her that he was kind of the prodigal son, that money had been put aside for his education. He never used it. He blew it. He thought he could make it on personality, and he didn't. He was a failure. And he never told her. He never told anyone anything. His motto was, keep your bowels open and your mouth shut. This is the way you get along. This is the way you stay out of trouble. And I remember hearing that well into the night. Don't take it. Why not? Don't take it. Why not? Don't take it. Why not? And sadly enough, that was their marriage. They never met at that deeper level that can only be experienced when two people are willing to risk the sharing of their deepest feelings. If my father had been willing to tell my mother how he felt, if my mother had been willing to share with him in a peaceful and loving way her own private agony, poverty, it would have been very different. The angel could have written a very different epitaph on the tombstone. I would like now to share with you a very poignant moment in my own life. When my father came to die, I had been ordained a priest, and I was standing at his bedside in a hospital in Chicago, Illinois. My mother was sitting saying a rosary on the other side of the bed, and my father sat up, and his eyes widened and his face filled with awe. I knew he was dying. I knew he was dying because my father never showed feelings on his face like that. I knew he was seeing something extraordinary and awesome. And I instinctively put my hand behind his head, and then he fluttered, and I lowered his head onto the pillow and closed his eyes in death. And I said to my mother, Mom, it's over. It's over. Dad is dead now. And she leaned across the bed and she said, oh, he loved you so much. He was so proud of you. And I remember for one moment standing there, feeling like something had hit me in the chest and had dropped down, something that I couldn't take inside. And I told her, I think I should go get a doctor to verify death. And while I was out in the corridor looking for a doctor, it came to me. I knew why she said that. And when we were back in the hospital room and the doctor was examining my father's corpse, a sister who had nursed my father there in the hospital came in and she consoled my mother. And then she came over and tried to console me, and I was crying and I couldn't talk. And the sister was saying, it's a blessing, you know, that your father died. You know, he could have never recovered completely. And I wanted to say, sister, I know that, and I'm not crying because my father's dead. I know that's a blessing. I'm crying because my father never told me he loved me. I'm crying because my father never told me he was proud of me. My mother had just told me. Oh, I knew. Sure, I knew. I heard that he bragged about me to other people, but he never told me. He never told anyone anything about his deepest feelings. He was afraid. Afraid, perhaps, of some form of adolescent rejection. But he never told us. And on the way home from the hospital after his death, my mother said, "You know, if your father had been a loving man, I think I would be insane with grief." But he wasn't. And I remember my fists tightening on the steering wheel of the car and wanting to scream, "Oh, he was a loving man. Oh, didn't you know that?" But we never knew him. No one ever knew him. He kept it all inside. We didn't know him. When the doctor said in the hospital one day, "Did you know your father has had an ulcer for many years? An ulcer that has broken open and healed and broken open. It's from the x-rays we can tell that it's a chronic ulcer." Our family just looked at each other with open mouths saying, "No, we didn't know." And I wanted to say, "Just one more pain in his gut that nobody knew about." He couldn't share himself with us. And of course, we never shared ourselves with him. When I say he never told me he loved me, you know, I didn't tell him I loved him either. And I feel very badly about that. When I got home to our family home after the funeral was over, I went up to my father's bedroom that he had converted into kind of a hermitage. And he used to subscribe to Reader's Digest magazine, and he would write marginal annotations. This man does not know what he's talking about. This is a good idea. This is a lot of bull and things like that. And I said to my family, "Could I take those magazines back to the seminary with me?" And they said, "Sure, but what do you want them for? You know, they're all old." And I said, "I know. I want to read what Dad wrote. I want to try to find out who my father was." And I took him back to the seminary, and I read every single marginal note because I wanted to know my father. And he was gone. And there was no possibility now of knowing him. He carried all of his secrets to his grave. And even when I have what they call a controlled fantasy, I take an imaginary walk with my father, and I say, "Dad, who are you? What were you really like? Am I right in thinking, Dad, that you felt the stigma of failure on yourself?" He always says in that controlled fantasy, "Never mind. This is really sad, that very often we don't even share with people who are closest to us our deepest feelings because for some reason, and I suppose it is different in each of us, we are afraid of rejection. I'm afraid to tell you how I feel. You might laugh. You might be shocked. You might be disappointed in me. You might reject me." I once wrote a book, "Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am," was the title. And when I was in my office typing the final copy, a lady knocked on the door of the office and came in, and I said, "Can you wait just a moment?" And I was typing the last part of a sentence, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I'm typing a manuscript for the printer, a book called "Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am." And she said, "Do you want the answer?" And I said, "My dear, that is what the book is about." And she said, "Do you want my answer?" I said, "Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I want your answer." And she said, "I'm afraid to tell you who I am, Because if you don't like who I am, what do I do then? If I put on a mask and you don't like my mask, I can change that. You say, you're too serious. Okay. I'll be more fun. But if I really tell you who I am, if I really tell you about the deepest and most sensitive feelings of my being, and you reject me, where could I go? What could I do then? I have no other me. If you don't like my act, if I put my act on the stage, I can change my act. But if I put myself on the line, then what do I do if you reject me? And I think that this is the tragedy that's almost always involved in every failure of love. We're afraid to have ourselves in common. We're afraid to open up to others. We're afraid to tell them that we love them or how we feel. Lonely, afraid. You know, you say, you knew your father loved you. What difference does it make if he told you? And I say, oh, you don't understand. You don't understand if you say that. Oh, yes, I knew he loved me. But don't you think it would have been different if I had memories in me now of my father sitting there telling me he loved me? Don't you see that that would make a big difference? As you're growing up, you know, a large part of you are your memories. Woe to the kid that doesn't have memories of being hugged and kissed and carried to bed. Woe to the kid who doesn't ever sit in his mother or father's lap. Woe to the kid who never has heard from his parents, I love you. He's going to be deprived, even if he intuits in other ways, he's going to be deprived of the memories that make a person fully human and fully alive. It would have made a great difference. And after my father died, and I began to be educated in the laboratory of life and to realize some of the things I'm trying to share with you, I was very determined I would not let my mother die without knowing her. When you want to know someone, you don't go frisking them with questions. What does that look mean? What emotion were you just feeling? You heard what the man said. What are your deepest feelings? Come on. We are all so insecure that if someone approaches us with this probing, we want to build a big do not trespass sign. Private. If you really want to know someone, and you really want that person to have you and himself in common, you have to open up yourself first. Gently, say, this is who I am. And it's contagious. When you open up your feelings to another person, you have to be very careful that you're not just ventilating your emotions. You're not saying, I'm about to back up the emotional garbage truck and unload. Nobody wants to be a garbage dump. I have something on my chest and I have to get it off, and you want to listen or do you want to listen? But someone's going to listen. It never works. If your motive is ventilation, that's ultimately a selfish act, isn't it? I want to feel better, so I'm going to unload on you. The second dead-end street is when you open up your feelings to manipulate the other person. Say, Harriet, we've been married for 12 years and I've been very lonely. All 12 years. I was never lonely before then. Do you understand? What you're really doing when you open up your emotions to get the other person to feel responsible for them or to get the other person to do something about them. I'm lonely and I need someone like you is manipulation. What you do when you communicate is you say, this is who I am, and that's all I want to share with you. You don't have to feel responsible for my feelings Well, you don't have to take charge of my life and jolly me up if I'm lonesome. I'll take care of that. But I want you to know me. And that's why I'm telling you. I want you to know who I am. Because it's the only really precious thing I have to give you. Me. And I want you to know me. I did this with my mother. I would go and I would sit with her. And I would say, Mom, you know what? I'm a priest, and I think I'm afraid to die. Isn't that funny? I took a physical exam out at our hospital and went through all those tests, and when I went back a week later and the doctor was trying to read those charts and reports, every time he squinted, I almost jumped into his lap. What did you see? What did you see there? And I said, After I reflected on that, I began to think, I'm afraid of death. I'm afraid he was going to lay a death sentence on me. Isn't that strange, Mother? And she said, no. I said, you afraid of dying? No. She said, ever since you kids have been raised, I've never been afraid to die. I just think of death as Jesus and I are going to walk down a corridor together. We're going home. He's going to come and take me by the hand. But you know what I am afraid of, John? I'm afraid of pain. I'm afraid of a painful death. You know, I've had this miserable arthritis for so many years, and the nurses here in this nursing home get me into bed and out of bed, and it hurts. And so I asked Jesus, when you send the angel of death for me, could you have him tiptoe in here and kiss me softly while I'm sleeping? I said, I understand, Mom, yeah. She died last September 20th, and she was sleeping. And I thought, you know, you got all your prayers answered. He refused you nothing. She's a beautiful person. But what I wanted to share with you was an event, a peak experience in our sharing, our getting to know each other, that took place some 5-6 years before she died. The doctors felt that she had cancer of the liver, and they decided to have an operation, exploratory surgery, to check this, to make sure. My mother had a terrible fear of cancer. She nursed her own mother through death by cancer. And when the doctors said, we think that's it, we're 90% certain, it became my duty to tell my mother. I am convinced that everyone has the right to be challenged by death. And so I sat on the edge of her bed one night, the night before the operation. I said, Mom, I have to tell you this. They think you have cancer. And, Mom, I was wondering, do you want to go to confession? I had been her confessor for the last 15 years of her life. Because of the arthritis, she couldn't get up to church. And she said, yes, I do. And there was something remarkable about my mother. I'm the last of her children. And the way she looked at me and the way she talked to me, it was always the word baby in her eyes, in her voice. It's always her baby. And sometimes she would even introduce me as my baby. Except when she went to confession. And then I was her priest. And she used to have a formula she apparently learned as a little girl. It never varied. In the name of the Father. And then she would make her confession, which was like being stoned by popcorn. I used to think that her worst sins were about on the same level as my greatest virtues. And the ironic thing is, she always ended her formula of confession by saying that she wanted me to give her God's forgiveness if I thought she was worthy. And I used to think to myself, I'm not worthy to tie your shoelaces. If you're not worthy, the rest of us don't have a chance. But that night, the night before the surgery, she said she wanted to go to confession, and we went through that again. And when she came to the end and she said, would you give me God's forgiveness if you think I'm worthy? I said, Mom, You know, as a priest, I have brought your remorse to God, and I have brought you his forgiveness and his peace and his grace. But tonight, Mother, I want to bring you something else that I never have done before. I want to bring you God's word to you. As much as I can be in touch with you and with God, I really think he wants me to say this to you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your good life. Thank you for your good heart. Thank you for all the cups of cool water poured in my name. I said, Mom, you know, I remember a lot of those things. I remember the way you sewed our clothes. I remember the way you reheated food. I remember the way you put a cool cloth on our head when we were sick and rubbed Bics on our chest when we were had a cough. I remember a lot of that. I remember the thousands of sandwiches you wrapped in wax paper and put in little brown bags to be taken to school. But you know, Mom, that's only a small part that I remember of your great life. And I think what God wants me to say is that every single act of love, every prayer you said in the middle of the night, every time your eyes burned and your back ached and you went on, he knew that. And he wants me to tell you, I think, that it's all recorded indelibly in his own sacred heart. Thank you. You know, my mother would have never listened to that if it hadn't been in confession. If I had been functioning as her baby, I would have lasted about 10 seconds. But because I was her priest, she lay there in that hospital bed with her hands folded and listened to every word. And when I finished, she reached up and she took my head and she put it down on her shoulder. I can still feel her soft skin against my own cheek. And she said, "Don't be sad now. Don't be sad. If I should die tomorrow morning in that operating table, I want you to know this. I'm very ready. I've been keeping your father waiting for 10 years. I'm sure he's getting impatient. But what I want you to know is that I will die very happy. And one of the greatest happinesses of my life is that you are a priest. Is that God called my little boy to be his priest. And what I want to tell you is that if I do have cancer and I am going to die day by day, inch by inch, I don't want you just to come and watch me. I don't want you to have a box seat at my last agony. John, God has called you to serve his people. I don't want you back. I gave you up once. I don't want you back. We'll spend eternity together in heaven. But I want you to honor your commitment and to serve the people that God has called you to serve. And don't be sad for me. Please, just know that I'm proud of you and that I love you." And I turned into a geyser of tears and I walked out into the corridor where my family was waiting, and their reaction was, "Oh, the kid broke down." Oh, don't you know the family motto about keeping your bowels open and your mouth shut? Didn't you hear the story about a stiff upper lip? The kid broke down. You know what I wanted to say? Hey, I'm not crying because Mom might be dying. I'm crying because I got to know her tonight in a way I never did before. She's beautiful. And I remember going into a dark linen closet of the hospital and leaning against the racks there, and just crying very, very warm and grateful tears to such a mother. The next morning when the doctor came out of surgery, he said, "I have some very good news for you. Your mother does not have cancer." And we thought, "Oh." He said, "No, it was a gallstone that got clogged in the duct that leads to the liver, and we were able to repair that." So I said, "Doctor, where is she?" He said, "Well, she's down in the recovery room right now." And I said, "May I have 1 minute with her?" He said, "Yes, but be sure it's just a minute. It's all I need, doctor." So my sister and I went running down to the recovery room, and I got down by the side of my mother's bed, and they had those iron sides up, and I said, "Mother, Mom, this is John. You do not, underline not, you do not have cancer. You are going to be all right. Can you hear me?" And she said, yeah, and so can everybody else in this place. And when my sister tried to comb some hair back that had gotten matted down on her forehead during the surgery, she said, Rita, will you stop pulling my hair? And then with one eye closed and the other eye fluttering, she turned to me and said, where's the TV down here? And I said, Mom, this is not your hospital room. This is the recovery room. There's no TV. And she said, with all the money you pay these people, you think they could put a TV down here? And then a thought crossed my mind, a warm thought that I have just delighted in ever since. I was standing there listening to my mother complain, and I thought, it's okay. It's okay, old girl, go ahead. They just cut your body open and sewed it together again. Your mind is still foggy from the anesthetic. Your vision isn't clear, I understand all that. And you're saying things that are expressing your pain, they're displaced emotions. But last night I got to know you. And you could say anything now, and it'd be all right, because last night I got to know you. Last night you told me who you were, and you are a great woman. And I will always love you, and I will always treasure your memory. It's all right. And then I thought, isn't that the way with most of us? In the dust of daily battle, we say things like, where's the TV? Don't pull my hair. Yeah, and so can everybody else hear you. These are things that are born of pain, of momentary pain in the dust of daily battle. But it's okay if you really shared yourself. If you really told those you love that you love them. If you really told them how you really feel about them and how you feel about yourself, it's okay. Because it only takes a moment to be loved the whole life through. It's those moments, those peak experiences of communication when we really get to know one another that make all the difference. One time a lady came up to me after a talk and she said, you know, Father, my little boy, 15 years old, was electrocuted by lightning. And the night before we buried him, my husband didn't come to bed, and I called to him. He said, I'm coming. And when he didn't come, I went out and he was writing at the desk. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm writing a note to our boy. I said, you want to read it to me? Said, yeah. My dear little boy, I never told you I loved you. I never told you what a large part of my heart you occupied. I never told you what a large part in my life you played. I always thought there would be a right moment when I could tell you all these things. When you left for school, when you went away to college, when you got married, there would be a right moment, and then I could tell you all you meant to me. And now you're gone, and there never will be a right moment. And I do hope that God will let you see these words wherever you are and know that I love you, your dad. And she said he folded that note and he put it under his son's body and it's buried with him. And I think it's the same tragedy of non-communication, the same tragedy of privacy, of fear, the same tragedy that we really do not share ourselves with one another. And I know that we all need love. We all need understanding. We all need to take a risk for one another, the risk of sharing our deepest selves with each other. It only takes a moment to be loved a whole life through. And to practice what I'm trying to preach, I would like to tell you that I have really felt very warmly received and very gratified to be in your wonderful country and to meet your wonderful people. I'm very grateful to the Catholic Family Welfare Bureau in Melbourne and the Center Care here in Sydney for inviting me. And I want you to know that I have loved you. God bless you. Good night.